I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information on all that Carthage offers is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending most of the hour today with a woman named Kelly Scroggins Powell. And it is very possible that you already know about the important work that she is doing in the community of Racine as executive director and co-founder of a group called Racine Women for Racial Justice. We will be finding out from her a bit more about the Facebook page that was created back in September of 2019 to foster some discussions about racial issues and issues of equity and justice here in southeastern Wisconsin. And this Facebook page began in the fall of 2019, and that was well before the events that included the death of George Floyd in May of 2020, and the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha in August of 2020. As a matter of fact, Kelly Scroggins Powell and I are recording this conversation on Monday, August 23rd, the one-year anniversary to the day of the shooting of Jacob Blake. And we're going to be talking about some of the important dimensions of the questions that this group is taking up, the concerns that surround just treatment from both law enforcement and the judicial system for blacks, indigenous people of color, and what can be done to make these systems more just, more equitable, and the way in which those that have been mistreated can receive justice. Kelly Scroggins Powell, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I do want to mention that WGTD listeners may recognize your name and recognize your voice from an appearance that you made some months ago on one of our weekend programs, Community Matters. And it was a segment hosted by Laura Sumner Kuhn, in which you discussed Racine Women for Racial Justice. Today we will be talking, among other things, about a new justice initiative that your group has just announced. Before we talk about Racine Women for Racial Justice, I think it would be nice if our listeners could get a sense of who you are, what is important to you, maybe a bit of information about where you're from, and maybe a bit about your life's path that leads you to this present day and to the work that you are doing.
Wow. Again, thank you for inviting me to be here and just to connect with our community. I often hear the question, like, where are you from? And so most people are surprised to hear that I am from Racine. My family moved to Racine when I was about 2 years old, and I grew up here. I was educated here. I was educated at parochial schools. here in the Racine area up until about maybe 10th grade, and which I transferred to the public school system here, graduated from Park High School. And so Racine is home. I've grown up in Racine. I often share with people some of the best times of my life. They were here in Racine, best memories here in Racine. And so I grew up in Racine. I did move away for about 13 years, even though I lived in southern Indiana at that time and also in Louisville, Kentucky. I continue to keep my ties to Racine because my father is here. My family members are here. And so I frequently visited what I call home. Racine is home for me. And so, so that's where I'm from. I'm from here. I'm a product of Racine. And I say that both proudly, but I also say that with some regret, because even as much as I love Racine, I was introduced to racism here in Racine. I came to understand what systemic racism is in Racine, definitely experienced interpersonal racism. And so as much as I love Racine, you know, I think it's important for me to always keep at the forefront that we have much work to do here in our hometown so that we can make this a better place for everyone to experience equality.
So explain to our listeners about the creation back in September 2019 of a Facebook page, which was, in a sense, a precursor of this group now called Racine Women for Racial Justice. I believe it was actually the brainchild of another woman, if I'm not mistaken.
No, you are absolutely correct. Back in 2019, there was a young man in the Racine area by the name of Tyrese West. Tyrese West was murdered by a Mount Pleasant police officer, and there was much outrage here in our community, a lot of public outcry. And many, many people in our community believed the details that led up to the chase of Mr. Tyrese West and the details surrounding how he was brutally murdered by a law enforcement officer. Many people believed that that evidence would come out, and people really believed that he would be found guilty. And so when he was not charged, a white lady by the name of Mary Pucci was so outraged that there was no justice for this young man. There was no justice for his family. She was outraged at the idea that a police officer could kill a child, a police officer with a record like Officer Geezy, and get away with it. So she went to Facebook, and she made a post about it. And to her surprise, hundreds of other women began to join in on this communication that she had on Facebook. And from there, there was a lot of interest from women of power and privilege who had for so long were completely unaware that systemic racism existed. They were appalled that for years they had lived in a world in which they were oblivious, just did not know. And so these women wanted to know more about this thing called systemic racism. And more importantly, they wanted to know what could they do to help eliminate systemic racism, you know? And so as a result, Mary formed the Facebook group, and then quickly women began to join. And then from there, we had the brutal murder of George Floyd. And from there, the Facebook began to grow. The women wanted to learn. They wanted to be educated around, you know, what does it really mean to be an ally? How do you advocate? You know, how do we use our voice? And so from there, we held our first event called Woman to Woman, Courageous Conversations About Race. And that was pre-COVID. And we brought together about 100 women to come together. And interesting to note is that there were 100 women from different races, 100 women from different economic backgrounds, different education levels. And it was an amazing event. And from there, we knew that we had an opportunity to empower women to take the lead in helping to make Racine a more equitable place.
And my understanding is now there are more than 1,200 people who subscribe to this Facebook page and, in effect, are members of this group, Racine Women for Racial Justice. One of the things that I would love to hear from you is the matter of this being a group, at least primarily, for women. Because, of course, women and men alike share concern about this, and men and women alike are the victims of some of the racism that we are talking about. And men and women, of course, need to be part of the solution. So I'm just kind of curious, the role you think that it plays for this to be a group primarily made up of women. I mean, in what way do you think that is maybe a source of strength for the group, or in what ways do you think that ends up strengthening the work that you are intending to do?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting to note that we are very intentional about our group being a woman-led, woman-only group, where our members are only women. We welcome collaborations, partnerships with other groups that, you know, have male members. And so we're definitely not opposed to working with men. Many of our initiatives, we partner with them. They serve as an advisor. They participate in some of our events. We participate in theirs. But I think the thing for us is that for so long, we've understood that when women come together, that women are able to accomplish what oftentimes has seemed to be the impossible. Mm-hmm. When we look at many of the other justice movements, any of the other movements that happened in our country, whether women were given their just credit, women have often been behind these major movements. And so we knew that right here in Racine, it was no different. As you can see, our group quickly grew to over 1,300 women. So that told us that there are 1,300 women in Racine that are concerned about racism in Racine. And we wanted to provide a place where we could empower women, where we could provide education, you know, to help women become the leaders that they are naturally created to be, and to give them voice and to let them use their skills, their abilities to lead a powerful movement. And we do believe we've done the right thing, because, like I said, we have over 1,300 women after we became incorporated and became a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We were able to put together a board of directors that is comprised, again, of women from different backgrounds, different, you know, classes, different education levels, just a diverse group of women. But yet our board really is predominantly women of color, and there have been times where we've been equal numbers of women of color and women of power and privilege, but we definitely have been successful in uniting and empowering women.
I read someplace in a list of four goals or objectives of the group that at the top, fostering strong, deep, and meaningful relationships among women in Racine, especially across the racial divide. In other words, trying to foster more connections, more friendships between women who perhaps in the past have not naturally fallen into relationships or friendships, unless they happen to work together or happen to go to the same church or whatever it might be, but trying to build these connections. How have you gone about doing that?
Well, you know, first of all, I want to speak to how important it is to do that. So many times what we see the effect of people receiving negative messaging or negative messages about opposites, about others, right? So we, as African Americans, I am sure that we have received negative messages about, you know, white people, about people of power and privilege, and as they have. And oftentimes what we have found to be true, and there's science to back this up, is that when people come together, when people are in spaces that have been created for them to enter into dialogue, you know, no matter how difficult the dialogue may be, when people come together and they talk about and they talk through tough issues, we get to really know each other. And so we think that has been important. And so like our one event, Woman to Woman, Courageous Conversations, you know, there was built into those events are opportunities to meet and greet and socialize. You know, we get to know each other. We share contact information. And then we see a continuation of that rich dialogue continuing as women build those interpersonal relationships. Social events. Right now we're launching our book club that our first discussion group is going to be September 11th. And this is where a group of women within the group have all come together to read the same book. And now we're going to meet and we're going to talk as we get to know each other and talk about this book. And so we do think that it's important, and which is why we try to create these events. Education opportunities over this last year, because of COVID, we've had to rely on virtual events. But we've been able to, again, bring in hundreds of women as they participated in some of our education and training programs. And women have had the opportunity to get to know each other and to even break down barriers, dispel myths, and to build friendships that will really, really strengthen our ability as people to be united and to live in harmony with one another.
We're speaking with Kelly Scroggins-Powell, who is executive director and co-founder of Racine Women for Racial Justice. We are recording this interview on Monday, August 23rd, which happens to be the one-year anniversary of the shooting in Kenosha of Jacob Blake. And the precursor to Racine Women for Racial Justice was a Facebook page that was created in September of 2019 and now has more than 1,300 members or followers who are, in essence, part of this group called Racine Women for Racial Justice. Kelly Scroggins-Powell, I think one of the most vexing challenges when it comes to working on an issue like racism is that you gather together, in this case, an already formidable group of women united in their concern and determined to make a difference. And yet there are all kinds of people out there who do not see this as a problem or do not understand it as a problem. How does a group like Racine Women for Racial Justice consider that matter of reaching out to the farther community, to people who, for whatever reason at this point, do not share your concern or do not see and understand the systemic racism that is such a concern to you? And how does one make inroads when it comes to that matter?
Wow, you know, believe it or not, our group really was created for the person who does not share our views. So many times when we get involved in this work, we say things like we're preaching to the choir. And so what you tend to have is groups of people working with individuals that are already on board with this information, and they're already implementing it in their lives. So it kind of becomes a little redundant. But one of the things that we have tried to do in this space with over 1,300 women is to make every woman within that group feel valuable and to give honor to her voice, understanding that we all know at different levels and we all grow at different levels. And so our group is a private group, and I can't tell you how many times within the group there was a woman of power and privilege who may have asked a question, right, that was offensive to women of color. And, you know, your first reaction in a situation like that might be to remove that person from the group because they're being offensive. But one of our goals really is to help bring education and increase knowledge and awareness. So that person is not going to be removed from our group, but rather we're going to use that as an opportunity to help that person gain some insight into that particular issue, to help them identify what might be inside of them, to help them come to understand maybe the historical context of why they think or feel the way that they do. And we do that oftentimes by contacting that or those people individually. We do that in some of our small group discussions. Recently, we held a training called Microaggressions, the Microaggression Game, where we actually brought in a facilitator from Milwaukee, offered a free training so that people could learn to know what is a real microaggression. And I can't tell you how many times as a woman of color that I have been on the end of a microaggression, a coworker, a friend, a business owner would make a comment to me. And even though they meant no ill intent, it was just as harmful. And so things like a microaggressions training is something that we would offer those people that may not fully understand about systemic racism, may not fully believe that it happened. And so we use every opportunity to bring awareness, sharing testimonies and stories of people who have been, victims of the system, right? And so we believe education, awareness, and a whole lot of empathy and patience, and just recognizing that we all grow at different levels. And so we want to allow people to grow right where they are.
Nicely put. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Kelly Scroggins-Powell, who is executive director and co-founder of Racine Women for Racial Justice. I think one of the great challenges that is part of the work of what your group is doing is that racism in 2021 in many respects looks different, or often looks different, or manifests itself very differently than it once did, or at least primarily when one thought of racism and racists 50 or 60 years ago. I mean, you were thinking about a cross burning on someone's lawn, or a church being bombed, or that sort of thing. Overt racism of the ugliest sort that was unmistakable. And we are talking about a world now in which certainly those kind of terrible expressions of racism still exist, but it seems to me they are not the predominant face of racism, that often racism, or this thing we call systemic racism, is something that can be much harder to recognize. And in many respects, or in many cases, it is racism that is, at least to some extent, unintentional. I mean, that the person, in a sense, perpetrating it or giving life to it does not even recognize the racist attitudes that might be at the heart of some of the choices they make, or the things they say, or the things they do, or the ways in which they themselves are benefiting from a kind of system built on this kind of racism. Can you just talk about that, about the fact that we are talking about racism that is often quite widespread and yet sometimes so very hard to recognize, especially if you're not on the receiving end of it?
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt our work, along with other justice organizations in our city, our work is cut out for us. Because you're absolutely right. There are those that believe that because there are no cross burnings, there are no men riding on horses and cars with white sheets over their heads, that there are no signs in the window that says for coloreds only or for whites only. You know, they believe then that it does not exist. However, one of our goals, one of our jobs as an organization, and I would even dare to say one of our jobs as individuals, because I believe that every individual, especially those people of power and privilege, that once you know better, you do better, but you also have an obligation to educate others, other people that you're closely aligned with. And so those forms of racism are what we have used to gauge whether racism exists over the years. But we forget that although we are not currently seeing those types of blatant acts of racism, it really is the covert racism that is built into practices like redlining, that although there isn't a sign at the beginning of the block that says for whites only, that there really were systems put in place and kind of lines drawn in the sand, you know, that says these neighborhoods are reserved for white people. And what we're going to do is we are going to make sure that real estate companies, financial institutions, homeowner associations, we are going to have procedures and policies that are put in place in such a way that although we say that everyone is welcomed, the practices and the procedures that are being used will determine who really gets in those neighborhoods. And we see that. And unfortunately, too many people have grown up in white-only neighborhoods without even realizing, why is it there are no black people in my neighborhood? Because I know you couldn't believe it's because no black person wants to live in a nice neighborhood, right? There has to be a greater reason behind it. And so when you look at systemic racism, you look at things like redlining, you know, you begin to see that those systems are in place, and it becomes the responsibility of all community members to shed the light on those types of systemic practices so that our friends and family members that are walking around with blinders on because they only see what they see in their little circle, we have a responsibility to enlighten them. You know, when we talk about those types of intentional practices of racism, intentional or unintentional are just as detrimental to people of color when they are being locked out of, you know, success. You know, if I have a little moment, I'd like to share with you the results of a survey or a test that was done. I believe it was in 2004. A university conducted a test, and within the Milwaukee region, they took 100 white men and they took 100 black men, and they wanted to see, was there something systemically that would allow a white man to become employed over a black man? And after doing this test, of 100 white men and 100 black men, each of those men were given the exact same resume. Each of those men were coached to give the exact same answers in the interview. But the difference was the white men actually had felonies and criminal histories. At the end of this experiment, what we found is that even though more of the white men had criminal and felony records, at the end of this hiring little test, the white men walked away with more of the jobs. And so we ask ourselves, I believe that test was conducted by Northwest University, I believe. We ask ourselves, how is it that a white man with the exact same resume, with the exact same answers, but with a criminal felony record, how did he manage to get a job over a man of color who actually had a better history than he had?
It's really hard to argue against a study like that, and it really gets us thinking about the ways in which racism can reside in all of us. One of the stories that I often tell people is, as someone who I hope has never been, you know, the worst kind of racist, I still have to admit to certain moments when there was no question but I was demonstrating racism. I think of one of the first times I was in the city of Chicago, and I was in one of the hotels in downtown Chicago, and I was riding up to where my room would be, and the elevator doors opened on one of the floors, and suddenly a young black man got on the elevator with me, and it was just the two of us. And in that moment, I got scared, and I just stepped right off the elevator. And I mean, I didn't want to ride in the elevator with this black man. And I look back at that now, and I mean, I was relatively young, but still so foolish, and demonstrating, I mean, a kind of racism that I just find deplorable as I look back at that. And I'm not so naive as to think that aren't still some of those kind of attitudes that reside somewhere inside of me. And probably if most of us are really honest with ourselves, we need to confront that reality about ourselves and the ways in which we fall short of our own ideals.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think you make a good point in that if we would all be honest, I think due to the messaging that we have received, either through media, either through our whitewashed education systems, through the history of our country, or even by our own experiences or the experiences of other family members and friends, I think we all have a degree of racism in us. And so I'm always just shocked when people can stand there and look at me and say to me, you know, I don't have a racist bone in my body. And I would dare to say that's probably not true. You know, and I think one of the ways that we are going to begin to eliminate racism or even reduce racism is us all being able to take an honest look at who we are, or in your case, the example that you mentioned, our practices. What are the things that we do that, whether it's intentional or in those awkward moments, you know, that prove to us that there's more work for us to do? That doesn't make you a bad person. You know, that means that over the years you have received some message that you believe to be true about black men. And in that moment, there was some fear. But I also think that you're not the only one. I believe that part of the problems that we see in our country, even sometimes as it relates to our law enforcement officers, boils down to that. There is a perception, there is a message, there is a narrative about who black people are, who people of color are, who our black men are. And based off of that, we tend to get the types of responses and interactions that we've been seeing. And until we're all able to acknowledge that, I don't think we're going to do much in the way of reducing these negative outcomes.
Right. We're speaking with Kelly Scroggins-Powell, Executive Director and Co-Founder of Racine Women for Racial Justice. You've touched on one of the most important matters, which is really at the heart of why this group was created in the first place, namely questions that surround whether or not all people are treated fairly, equally, equitably by both the law enforcement system and the judicial system. And of course, we all know of the kind of incidents which have brought this kind of issue, these array of questions, so forcefully into the public eye, including the murder of George Floyd, the shooting of Jacob Blake, the death of Malcolm James, who died while in custody in the Racine County Jail, and the arrest of Deandra McCollum back in 2018, and the very real possibility that that excessive use of force was part of that apprehension and arrest. I'm curious to what extent your group has any kind of relationship with, for instance, the law enforcement community. If there is communication there, if you have engaged with law enforcement in any way, in terms of some kind of a dialogue to further advancement in some of these concerns? Or is that maybe something for down the road, if it's not occurred already?
Yeah, you know, I think I want to speak to that because I think that's so important. I think that when we recognize that there are issues or concerns that we may have as a community around policing, around law enforcement, so often people think that we want to get rid of or defund the police or, you know, just eliminate what the entire law enforcement system, you know. And I can speak for Racine Women for Racial Justice. That's not what we're saying. What we are saying to law enforcement, to the law enforcement officials, what we are saying to the city who oversees the budget for our city police department, the county who oversees the county sheriff's budget, what we are saying to the Racine police chief, what we are saying to the sheriff, hey, let's come together. Let's have a dialogue. Allow us to be honest about what our experiences are or those that have been reported to us. Hear what we have to say, value our experiences, and then let's work together to see if there are some solutions or antidotes that maybe won't fix the problem in its entirety right away, but let's work in a way that moves the needle of progress. So in a year or two or five or 10, we all can look back on this work where we all took some ownership, right? And we all took, made some effort. And now when we look up, Racine is really a better place. And so we welcome the idea and the possibility of talking with, you know, those law enforcement officials, you know. We have reached out to Sheriff Smelling. We have sent him an email. We followed it up with the actual written letter asking him for the opportunity to let's discuss some of the concerns that we have further. We've asked for certain information for him to release information to us under the Freedom of Information Act. You know, to this day, we haven't received a response, not even something as simple as we received your email and give us some time to respond. Nothing. But you know what's interesting, though, on the flip side of things, we reached out to Deputy Jesse Matoya, and we reached out to Chief Robinson, and we said, hey, we would like an opportunity to just meet you, and let's hear what some of your ideas are. Are there ways that we can help? Are there ways that we can partner? Let's talk about the problem that we have in Racine. And we've received a quite different response. Right away, we got a response to an email, and we have spent the last couple of weeks, due to all of our schedules being kind of, you know, kind of crowded, but we spent the last couple of weeks trying to identify a time where we can come together and just talk about what we see going on in Racine as it relates to law enforcement, and how Racine Women for Racial Justice and the other organizations that are a part of the Racine Racial Justice Alliance, how those partnering agencies, how we can build collaborative partnerships with law enforcement to make our city a better place.
I appreciate hearing that. Because I think sometimes, and I think it's understandable given the scope of the problem and how disturbing so many of these events are, I do think that there have been instances in which those with these kind of concerns find themselves painting with a very broad brush, in much the same way that a racist person is painting with a broad brush. I mean, often out of fear, often out of anger, or for whatever reason. But I think almost never is painting with a broad brush and making careless generalizations ultimately helpful when it comes to fostering greater understanding. And so I appreciate the care and concern with which you are speaking about this issue, which I think could be a very important stepping stone into building some connections that would be ultimately very, very productive. I know that your group champions very much the need for greater transparency. Can you tell us what kind of transparency from law enforcement that you are wanting? What kind of transparency is not in place that you hope will be in place?
Well, you know, we believe that the data will tell the story. We believe that, and so one of the things that we've requested most recently from the sheriff, we've asked so that we can, we want to be responsible. I want to say that. We want to be responsible to make sure that the data matches the concern. And so we asked for the data around excessive use of force reports dating as far back as 2018. We'd like to know how many times have canine dogs been used in apprehensions. We'd like to know how many times the tasers were used, how many times those incidents have happened. And we'd like to know if there is a racial demographic breakdown, you know, because based off the reports and the testimonies of the community, the video that we see even with Mr. McCullum, you know, we believe that reasonable people understand the difference between apprehending a perpetrator and excessive use of force. And so one of the things that I also want to say is that we are in no way supporting the notion that criminals should not be apprehended, should not be arrested. But we also believe that we live in a country that says innocent until proven guilty. We live in a country that says that even as a potential criminal, you have certain civil liberties and rights. And just because people wear a badge, it does not give them the right to violate your basic human rights. And that is to live, that is to breathe, that is to be uninjured, you know. And so we've asked for that information. And like I said, we have yet to get it. We want to make sure that we have information. We have worked. We're working with the National Alliance of Mental Illness because we believe that too often we are seeing those that are mentally ill or in a mental health crisis being treated as a common criminal. And we know that as common as mental illness is, that the way that you deal with a person who is in a mental health crisis is not so common. We believe that there are de-escalation techniques. There are trainings that would be available. And actually, just really, it would really be in the best interest of not only the person getting arrested, but of our law enforcement to make sure that every officer is trained in crisis prevention, crisis intervention, de-escalation. It shouldn't be on a volunteer basis. No, if you are going to be connecting and engaging with our community members, it should be a requirement, because at any given moment, you may encounter someone who has some type of mental health diagnosis or crisis, and the way you engage with them could make the situation, go completely out of control, or, you know, we could see this thing working out in a way that people are receiving mental health services. Mm. And so those are the kinds of things that we're asking our county officials, our city officials, to be open to some candid conversations, and let's work together to come to some solutions rather than deny these problems exist, rather than justify what we see happening in videos such as the one with Mr. McCollum being detained.
Right. I do want to add parenthetically that I had a conversation a few months ago with two of the gentlemen who head up the police training program here at Gateway Technical College, and I was really heartened to hear their sincere concerns about some of these issues, and was really mm-hmm. heartened to hear also about the ways in which their training program has changed dramatically to try to address some of these issues. And I certainly hope that in other training programs across the country that this concern is more and more at the heart of training police officers to be more effective in their challenging work, and so that we don't see these kind of terrible incidents. In our closing couple of minutes, how hopeful are you about the possibility of real and lasting change coming about?
How hopeful? I am so hopeful. I am very hopeful, because, listen, this work is hard. I believe I heard the former Chief Howe say, he was talking one time, he said, this is a heavy lift. And, you know, this is a heavy lift. This is not a popularity, you know, thing. You know, you don't gain a whole lot of friends when you stand up against the system. And so I do this work. We do this work because we are hopeful. We are hopeful that there are people in our community that love Racine. There are people in our community that we want to see our name off of that list. We don't like being the second or third worst place in this country for African Americans. And so I'm very hopeful that with all of us working together, you know, being open and honest and really looking for real solutions, not just trying to put a Band-Aid on something, not just doing something for a promotional or a media, you know, effect, but really trying to get to the heart of the matter to make some real change. I am so hopeful. You know, the day I lose hope that it's even a possibility, it's the day I go home and hang up my hat.
Well, I can sense just from the energy and strength of what you've been sharing with us today. I mean, the strength and energy in your voice that you very much do have hope, and there is reason to hope, certainly. Kelly Scroggins-Powell is Executive Director and co-founder of Racine Women for Racial Justice, and you can go to Facebook and do a search to find their Facebook page and become part of them. And you can also there learn more about their Justice Initiative, which was recently announced. Kelly Scroggins-Powell, I really appreciate you making time in your schedule for this conversation, have enjoyed meeting you and hearing about the good work that you are doing. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you. And they can also find us on our website at www.rwrj.org. We do have a website, rwrj.org.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we're talking tennis. My guest, Christopher Clary, is tennis correspondent for the New York Times and the author of a wonderful new book called The Master. The Long Ride and Beautiful Game of Roger Federer, who, of course, is one of the greatest tennis players we have seen in recent years. In part two of today's program, I'll replay a portion of a conversation from a few years back with L. John Wertheim from Sports Illustrated, his book called Strokes of Genius.